We're going to be talking about motivational interviewing. One of the reasons that I'm glad to be able to present about this is I believe that most of us at some point are going to be involved in training others. There are so few Christian counselors. There are so few people working in the church to strengthen marriages and families and work with people in crisis that really it's up to us to pass on what we know to others so that they can learn how to come alongside and do some of the basic encouragement work that they're able to do. And this is a model that you will be able to follow exactly. I didn't make any of this up. This is a very prescribed kind of a model. It's been researched a lot, I'll just say that. The man who developed this is named William Miller, and he is at the University of New Mexico, and he is a believer. He's a Christian. And he started this research in the 80s and wrote his first book on the topic in 1991. And since then, he has become the most quoted academic researcher in the world. I mean, this stuff is used all over the place in many, many settings. So I'll talk a little bit about that. But let me just give you an idea of why it's so important for us to have good question-asking skills and good listening skills as we approach people who are struggling. Just a few weeks ago, I was involved in a coffee house ministry with my family. We do this every so often. It's an outreach to university students. I have been playing music for since I was a kid, and I play in restaurants and I do all kinds of things. And over the years of us being in Hungary, I have learned a new instrument, and I have joined the Roma people in playing their music. And so we go around playing gypsy worship music, and then I've been able to record a lot of it and write it down, because most of their music is not written down. Most of my musician friends don't know anything about music, and so it's my job to actually put it into writing, not just the notes, but the text itself, and then to record it, to preserve it. Otherwise, if one person died, it would all disappear. So there we were with my family, and we're doing this coffee house ministry. There's a break between sets, and I come alongside a young man. I had seen him before at the coffee house, and I ask, well, how are you doing? What are you doing? Good opening questions. And he says, well, I'm done with university now, and I'm looking for work. Well, in motivational interviewing, one of the things that they identify as a reflex that we need to avoid is the reflex of trying to make things right in another person's life. They call it the righting reflex. And while I'm starting this conversation, another believer who's doing ministry there comes alongside the two of us and says, "You're out of work?" These are his exact words. "I'll tell you what's wrong with you." And I'm like, "Oh no." That's not a good opener in counseling that I know of. And he says, "You're not even trying." He said, "Have you made a resume? Have you made a CV? You know, I told you to do that before. You haven't even done that, have you?" I knew you hadn't. "You don't even want to take a risk, do you?" And the clincher was how he ended it. He goes, "You are never going to feel like a real man until you get a job." Now, you are all in the counseling field, you're believers. What do you think happened to this man's countenance during this conversation? it just plummeted. You know, and there I am with the aftermath of this writing reflex session, and this guy is just devastated. I mean, he's, you know, I didn't know, should I apologize for this other guy? You know, should I tell him, you know, don't worry about that, you're going to be okay? I was really at a loss because I was just as in shock as this other guy. Well, I wish I could have taken this young man aside and spent longer time with him, but my wife was able to be a great encouragement to him. She is a wonderful encourager to people, and that was a real blessing. Well, let me tell you a little bit about back in 1992 and 93. I was working at a big medical center as a part of a fellowship after I had finished my degree. And one of my responsibilities was to go into the medical school and talk to the medical school students about how to do interviewing, how to ask questions. Well, why is that important? Doesn't a doctor just know how to, you know, say, okay, what are you feeling and what are your symptoms? And okay, here's a prescription or here's a treatment. Well, if that's all there was to it, most of those communications between a doctor and a patient would go very well. But you know what it's like to be with a physician that is not really there when you're talking to them. You're like, hello. Hello, I'm here. I'm the one hurting. It's my leg, you know, and you think this person is not even in the room. And how likely is it that you are going to feel like complying with that doctor's treatment or that doctor's prescription if you are not listened to? Not very likely. So the statistics are is that the vast majority of patients who meet with a doctor and they're given a prescription, a medication prescription, do not follow those instructions. So it makes it very hard for pharmaceutical companies to do research on effectiveness because most people, they're not even taking the drug or they're not taking it like they should. So it was our job to begin to use some of the basic techniques that Miller was talking about with listening to help physicians or some physicians in training to learn how to ask good questions and to listen. And this led to greater compliance. It led to greater outcome of the treatments. And it led to greater physician satisfaction because they enjoyed their work more. They had better relationships, better communication, better connection emotionally with the people that they were talking to. And it led to less burnout researchers. So not that I was a part of it, but research was shown that doctors who were so frustrated with just saying to somebody, you know, you need to lose weight. Well, yeah. How many people are going to comply with that, you know, program? People don't. They need help in learning how to do that. And that led to less burnout for physicians who understood how people actually could move to be changed in their behavior. Well, as they began to teach motivational interviewing as a specific program, they realized that while they're explaining all these specific skills, you know, do this and then do this and do that, many of the people who were trained would go back to their counseling practice or medical practice or education or working as a police officer, and they would go right back to doing what they had always done. They didn't actually, you know, comply. They didn't actually follow the program. And they realized that they weren't conveying really what the spirit of motivational interviewing is that you need to develop a partnership with the person that you're talking to. And according to Miller, he said people are not resistant or cannot change because they lack information. They cannot change because they are ambivalent. And motivational interviewing tries to get to the struggle that a person has between wanting to change and not knowing how to change. Or the struggle of feeling like they can't change and the advantages of not changing. So in motivational interviewing, the counselor is committed to partnering with the client in a collaborative relationship, accepting the perspective of the client, keeping the client's best interest in mind, and working to draw out the ideas and solutions and reasons for change from the client. And I like this quote from Blaise Pascal: people are generally better persuaded by the reason which they have themselves discovered than by those which come into the minds of others. So motivational interviewing follows a basic rule. It's different from traditional counseling models, especially the kind of relationship that's set up in a physician's office, where there is an expert and the client is a passive recipient of whatever advice they're going to receive. So the motivational interviewing model is quite different from that. In this model, the counselor, the advisor, the helper, the physician resists the tendency to try to fix the problem. They work hard to understand the perspective. They listen actively with open questions, and they try to empower the client by helping them discover their own motivations for change. Initially, motivational interviewing was taught as something that happens in stages. And it turns out there are still stages. There's kind of a beginning stage, a middle stage, and an end stage. But what is more important than these specific stages are four processes. And the processes involve first engaging, developing a good communication pattern with the client and good emotional connection with the client. And then focusing the conversation in a specific direction. You're not just there to listen to everything and talk about everything. You have to then begin to guide that conversation in a purposeful way. And as you begin to move that conversation in a purposeful way, you begin to find the main issue that a person needs to talk about, and then you draw out from them, that's the evoking, you draw out from them their ambivalence. Well, what has been hard about approaching this problem in the past? Why do you think you haven't succeeded? What are the advantages of kind of staying stuck in the place that you're at? Not typical questions that we would think about asking because it seems negative, but really it's in the life of the person that there's a part of them that doesn't want to change. There's a part of them that is hooked, that is stuck, that is using that problem that they're struggling with as a crutch. So when you have a crutch after a while, I mean, you get a crutch because you have a bad leg, but then after a while, you think, well, you know, my leg isn't so strong anymore and this crutch is pretty sturdy. I think I'll just hang on to the crutch. And then they are left handicapped by having a solution now that has become a problem. Then the planning begins as that goal is identified. You worked on identifying the ambivalence, and then specific steps need to be taken. So those are the four processes actually that are being cycled through again and again throughout the counseling process. It's not just this happens in one stage and then another. It's a process that you keep going back. And the bottom line of this whole process is the engaging. If you sense a disconnection between you and the person that you're talking with, it doesn't really matter what's other processes going on. You have to reconnect and you have to figure out, okay, where did this disconnect happen? Well, the observation that Miller had made is that people do not change because they are told to change or because they should change. People change because they want to. And that is a very helpful concept when you're looking at a person who seems so lost in their addiction. And the addiction is their friend. The addiction is their life. But it's in looking at a person in that setting, it's very easy for us to think, well, there's not a ray of light in that person's life that wants something else. But there is. There is something within them that wants more. Well, as we begin the beginning stage, the engaging, there are four techniques that are used to develop that good relationship. And that's open questions and affirmations, reflections, and summaries. And when we're asking open questions, what we are doing is inviting them to talk about their life. And sometimes it's very subtle how we ask a question. The focus in the question might be fine, but how we ask it is going to make a difference between them just reporting to us like we're the teacher or we're the professor, you know, I answered your question, or we're inviting them to talk. And you want to ask a question in a way where you're inviting them to share their life. And these examples, tell me a bit about your life growing up versus where did you grow up? I grew up in Michigan. Okay, got a good answer there. Did you learn about my life? No, I mean, I answered your question. But if you leave it, tell me about your life growing up. How does alcohol fit into your life? What kinds of things do you do now for relaxation? Those are things that you are saying, hey, I'm interested in you. I'm interested in having you share about your life. And in doing that, you're developing that kind of partnership relationship, that they are feeling that, hey, you know, this person is sitting at the level that I'm at. And that's a good picture to keep in mind as you're talking. Well, what are reflections? Reflections are statements made to the client that mirror, repeat, or paraphrase what the counselor heard. And in motivational interviewing, it's specific that a reflection is given with confidence and generally not closed with, did I get that right? Okay? Because that is a little tag that is often used in a person-centered Carl Rogers type approach of non-directive counseling. But this kind of a reflection is a statement. I'm not sure why I'm here. My doctor told me to come. You're not sure why your doctor referred you to me. You know, and it, and you're thinking, oh, you know, that sounds like a parrot. But you're tracking with where the client is at, and they're sensing that you're going to be walking through them in the statements that they're making, not challenging them, and not, you know, creating some kind of barrier for them to continue talking. Let's say the conversation goes on, and the person says, you know, I want to be a better parent to my child, and I know my wife is worried about what I'm doing, but I'm just not sure how drinking has anything to do with it. So you could reflect. It sounds like you are very concerned about your family and wonder if alcohol is really a serious thing with you or not. Yes. And you continue on. Well, the difference with a summary is basically a summary is a kind of technique that you would use when it's time to transition. You've heard about one area of their life for a few minutes, and it's time to go on. And to help set that transition up, you use basically a long reflection. You take, you know, different parts of what they have said, and you put them all together, and then you basically bring a close to that section, that kind of thing that they've been talking about, and move the conversation on. Well, affirmations are short statements that can be made anytime you see an opportunity. Motivational interviewing suggests that people who feel bad about their behavior or made to feel bad about the behavior are not any more likely to change. So one of the programs that has happened in some parts of the world are people who have been victims of drunk drivers have formed, you know, huge organizations, and sometimes a judge will sentence somebody in their court case to go and hear the testimonies of people who have lost loved ones from drunk drivers. Well, studies have shown that people who hear these very, very traumatic stories of lost loved ones, you know, due to drunk drivers, they are no more likely to participate in a treatment program than people who are not, and are more likely to go back to their drinking. And what motivational interviewing tries to encourage the counselor, the physician, the helper to do is look for opportunities to affirm that people are more likely to be affiliated, to be connected with you, and to comply with you when they feel encouraged by you. Basic idea. Thank you for coming today. You seem like a person who can accomplish what she sets her mind to. And I like to say to people when they come in and they haven't maybe met a goal and they feel kind of sheepish, to use that opportunity right there to affirm them. You know what? It must have been hard for you to come today knowing that you had to share with me that you had a pretty bad week. That's a great opportunity. And they're like, it was hard. I didn't want to come. You know, I didn't want to have to tell you that, yes, once again, you know, I fell on my face. Thank you for being honest with me. That kind of honesty I can see growing in you. That's great. Again, boom, you're giving them a positive affirmation. How powerful are affirmations? B.F. Skinner, father of part of behaviorism called operant conditioning, he was giving a lecture at Harvard. And his students, being wily as students are, had conspired. And while he paced back and forth on the stage giving his lectures on operant conditioning, his students decided that they would give him eye contact and little nods, but only when he stood on the left side of the stage. And within 20 minutes, B.F. Skinner was pinned to the far left side of the stage. And even though he gave four or five more lectures that day, he spent the rest of the day on the left side. We need those kind of affirmations from people. And it influences us, even if we're not even consciously aware that it's happening. Well, you're not just there to, as I said, just hear a story. The conversation has to be moved to the kinds of things that the client needs to be working on. And this is when you begin looking for target behavior. So motivational interviewing is a strategy that helps a client recognize how their problem behavior is in conflict with an important goal in their life. So like the case that I shared yesterday, the person coming in was not saying alcohol was a problem. What they're saying is their life wasn't going the way it wanted. He had kind of anxiety symptoms and other problems. But there was this issue with alcohol. And as I was listening to the story, I was listening, well, how is alcohol in conflict with this person's goals that they had in their life? So what kind of changes do you want to make in your life? How would you like things to be different for you? And depending on the work setting that you're in, if you're in a community mental health type of setting, if you're working for a state agency, if you're working for a public hospital, you're going to see people who are not there voluntarily. And you have to start with where they're at. Yes, they are there because they were told to come, but they have a problem of some kind that they want to see changed. So you ask specifically for that. What goals do you have for changing your behavior? So there are two specific questions that you ask, and these are exact questions that people who study this memorize and use. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 0 is not important at all and 10 is crucially important, how important is you that you make this change? The second one, on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is no confidence at all and 10 is completely confident, how confident are you that you can make the change? So these two questions get at the importance of this, how much do I value this, and how confident am I that I can actually pull this off? Now, there are two follow-up questions that you ask for each of those numbers. You take the first number that they give. Why did you pick 6 and not a lower number? Not a higher number, but a lower number. And it gets them to start saying the positive things that they're interested in seeing changed in their life. What would it take to move the higher number? And they begin to think about it. Whose reasons are they coming up with? Yours? No, their own. These are my reasons that I want to see this happen in my life. That's motivational. So what do you avoid? You avoid things that build a wall between you and the client. Things such as asking a lot of diagnostic questions. I believe that accurate diagnosis and ferreting out different disorders is very, very important, and there's a place for it. But in this process, it might be better if somebody else, another colleague, maybe a physician or somebody else, did that kind of diagnostic assessment, or that you use instruments that were given to a person beforehand. Telling a person how to fix their problem. Trying to avoid using your status as some reason that they should listen to you. Labeling them or needing them to accept a label of having a specific problem before they can get help. There is a place for advice giving. There is a place for information giving. And it comes in motivational interviewing as a person is beginning to work on the steps that they need to take toward change. And a question is asked, would you like to hear how other people with this kind of problem have taken steps toward change? And they say, yes, I would like to hear. And you have an open door to give them both information and advice. Once you focus on change, and change begins to emerge, the counselor begins to listen for how the client is talking about the problem. So this is now stage two. I said there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So this is the middle part. In the middle part, you begin listening for the words that they use that are indicating their ambivalence, their struggle, their desire for something different in their life. They say, I wish my life were different. I don't want to end up like my mother. They talk about their ability. I am going to quit. They give reasons. You know, I'll be able to enjoy a night out and not be so hyper-vigilant all the time and worried. They talk about a need. I have got to make more money. I have got to get out of this job that I'm in and find something different. They talk about commitment. I intend to go to the next AA meeting that I can find, and I am going to keep going. And as you begin to hear that kind of language, you do a very specific thing. You think in your mind, okay, how can I help them see that there's a plus side to this and a negative side to this. How can I help draw out ambivalence that they have, that there's a part of them that really wants to go in this new direction, and then there's a part of them that is really afraid and insecure and resistant to doing that. And you do it by asking these kinds of questions, evoking questions. Well, why is it again that you want to change? Elaborating, tell me more about how you've overcome problems in the past. And that helps draw on strengths that they might have. Strengthening the side of their ambivalence that is leaning toward change. Ask about the best and the worst. What's the best thing that would happen if you started to change? Well, what do you think the worst thing would be? They haven't thought about that. As they change, their whole social network changes. They lose friends. They lose routines. They lose activities that they used to be a part of. Help them think through that. Looking back, what was life like before you started drugs? You remember the question that I asked that I felt was a key question in this case that I mentioned yesterday? What were your goals for your life then? And the question that I use, what were your goals? What did you want to do with your life before you became an addict? And that brought out for him his deep longing desire that he really saw that his addiction was preventing him from going in a direction that his life wanted to go. Looking forward, where would you like your life to be in 5 years? And that, for some people, can be in a very exciting question because they have been so trapped in their problem that they have not even been able to think about the next day, hardly a year from now, and never 5 years from now. And they realize, you know, I can begin to think of what my life will be like as I am free from what I'm struggling with now. Then you need to work on developing a plan. You develop a plan, and you need to make it specific, meaning measurable. There has to be a day, a time, and a way to measure specifically what a person says that they are going to accomplish. Saying, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to have an improved mood, you have to say, no, let's find something that we can actually measure. And as you wrap up, you help that person look through all the things that are going to be a challenge for them in the future to help prepare them for the reality that relapse happens, that they take a step forward and they take a step backward and they move forward in increments. I like what somebody defined as an optimist. An optimist is somebody who believes that taking one step forward and two steps back is not really a bad thing. It's more like doing the cha-cha, you know. And that's how we go forward in life, you know, a little bit at a time. I appreciate the time. Thank you.